Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
I'm joined in the studio by an award-winning autistic writer and performer. Neurodiversity features very strongly in her work, as seen in her latest play, Grace, which is on at the Pavilion in Dunleary as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. She's here to tell us all about it and why we should go and see it. Jodie O'Neill, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having
me. You're very welcome. We'll get to Grace in just a little bit. But first, will you tell us about how you became diagnosed in your late 30s?
Yeah, of course. So I didn't really sort of had a very sort of pedestrian understanding of autism for all of my life, because I grew up in the 1980s where, you know, if you were making it out the door to school, you were grand. but I had a sort of profound sense of feeling different, I suppose, throughout my whole life, and that the way that I experienced and interacted with the world was different. After my son was diagnosed as autistic, and we were looking into services which really weren't there and kind of finding community as a family experiencing neurodivergence, I realised there was just so much work to be done. There was so much misunderstanding.
Can I ask, how old was he?
He was four.
He was four, yeah. And you're in your mid-30s.
I was in my mid-30s, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to get the picture straight.
Yeah, of course. And then over the coming few years, I became interested in making theatre work. So I was writing for Fair City at that time and not planning to make any more theatre. And then I kind of realising how much of a misunderstanding there was about what autism actually was, I started to really deep dive into it, and I hyper-focus. So I dived very, very deep and kind of sought out members of the adult autistic community to find out what their experiences
also
were.
Also an attribute, hyper-focus, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, 100%, yeah. And then finally, along the way, it kind of dawned on me that actually this was an experience that explained a lot of my life, really, and a lot of my experiences.
That's fascinating.
From childhood and through adulthood, yeah.
Wow. Do you remember, was there a eureka moment where you're like, I think this is me?
It was more gradual than that. And yeah, then I did go and seek a formal diagnosis. But I think it was more that as I spent more time around neurodivergent adults and young people, I was like, just a very strong sense of finding my tribe.
Okay.
I guess. And also then a kind of a gradual explanation of a lot of the things that I would have struggled with, or what would have been challenging for me, or what would have been easy for me as well, because there were huge strengths that came along with it. But yeah, so there wasn't a kind of an aha moment as such, but it was just like, okay, oh, I have that, I have that. I do that as well. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I didn't know that was that. So yeah, it was over time. It became something that I kind of self-identified with and then went and sought kind of formal help with it.
When you look back, do you recognise autistic traits in your childhood that you see in, maybe you saw in your son, the similarities?
And my son is really like me. It's probably important to say he now at 12 doesn't identify with any of these labels. He finds them really reductive, and he thinks that they kind of belong back in the 1940s when they first came about. And
that's
in
so
many
interesting
ways,
isn't
it's fascinating, his take on it,
because I hear that that's really
and you know, we have this whole thing around neurodiversity and embracing it and celebrating it, which is I think what we need to do. But then when we have things, you know, labels that include the word disorder, that's very problematic for people to go, well, there's nothing wrong with you, you're just different, but you have a disorder. So I think that I think probably his generation will be the ones who change the labeling. And I think you know, we talk about the spectrum of autism, one person's experience of being autistic is so profoundly different from somebody else's, so it's not really satisfying. And I guess it's a label that serves a purpose in terms of a medical model, but maybe not so much in terms of the lived experience of people.
That's actually, the more I learn, is that the more unlabelable it is. Mm-hmm. And the more people resist the labels, because actually, like personality types, everybody's different, and that's what people identify with. That's what I'm learning as well. Is that right?
Absolutely. And it's not to kind of, you know, in any way take away from the fact that people are disabled by these conditions, because society isn't built to fit your needs. But for my son in the last few years, he's kind of gone, well, actually, I have personal needs. We all have personal needs. Everybody's are different, and everybody should have a right to have their personal needs met.
Yeah.
But as for the labels, he finds them, he did it quite
a lot. Isn't that amazing, though, that he can say that?
Yeah, it is.
Well done, you.
Yeah, I couldn't have said that at 12.
You should take credit for that, though.
I was just hiding under a rock.
Well, that's kind of what we did, right?
Yeah,
it's wonderful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
I think we have so much in common. We're so similar in how our brains work. But he doesn't have the same amount of fear that I had when I was younger. And so I spent so many years just trying to emulate what everybody was doing and trying to mimic and trying to copy behaviours. Yeah. And he thankfully doesn't have that instinct, which I think, you know, from a mental health point of view, will really serve him throughout his
life. And that's difficult for some of my generation to get your head around how you go to school and you're comfortable with not fitting in. Mm-hmm. How does that actually look in a day to day, how he lives?
In his day to day, his class are amazing. I have to say he's got an amazing group of young people around him.
They're so wise, aren't they, young people?
it's a really different thing. And, you know, one of the things about Grace as well, which I know we'll talk about in a minute, is we don't use the word autism in it, because actually the young people that I see now, they do identify support needs and they support people in the way that their peers need support and in how they feel that they need it. And they have a really different, and maybe we live in an extremely protected environment, I'm not sure, but my experience kind of across the board with groups of young people I work with is that there's so much more acceptance without the need to go, oh, you're this, you're that, and without the need to put somebody in the box.
She's 60 now, she'll kill me, my niece. I'm always saying, she's 14, she's 13. I ask her. And, you know, I'm an LGBT, I should know everything. And I'm like, how do we feel about this? And she, why does it matter to you? And her big thing is, why are labels so important to your generation? It's really interesting, isn't
it? Yeah. And, you know, I think it's because actually we didn't have any identity. So I was kind of desperately grasping for somewhere where I could put myself where I belonged. So when I found the label of autism, that was hugely empowering for me. But for younger people now, I'm not seeing it in that same need, because as long as your needs are met and as long as your environment is appropriate to those needs, then it's you belong.
And you've kind of stolen my next question, which is the cheesy, you know, obvious. Was it like a, you know, light bulb going on? You know, was it empowering? But it obviously was, and it would be, I understand, for me as well. If everything made sense all of a sudden, it's like a gift, right?
Yeah, it's a huge gift. It was interesting because I was right in the middle of making another show at the time. So the first talking about my diagnosis that I did was on the radio and in newspaper interviews. And I did it in a very much a way that I was like, well, I'm not going to talk to my friends about it. I'm not going to tell my family, but it's on national radio. So
let's give over that. So you talked about it publicly before you've talked about it to your family?
To some of my family, yeah. I remember, like, and not deliberately, but it just, I was like, we were kind of in the rush of, okay, we're in production now. And again, the hyper-focus thing of going, okay, well, you know, I'm talking about this story in relation to the show, but actually not then putting together the pieces that other people were going to be listening and going, oh, she hasn't told me that yet.
Wow.
But maybe they had worked it out. I don't know. It was really empowering. And then I think when COVID came, I became more aware of maybe the things that I struggle with, because I think I've always identified myself through my work.
Okay.
And my environment in terms of work has always really kind of suited my support needs. And so during COVID, when all of that was kind of taken away, that's when I think maybe the sort of deeper processing happened. And there's still things now that I go,
I feel like I need to ask, because when I was reading your brief and reading the articles in it, you do automatically, it's just a human nature thing, you go, oh, do I identify? What were the traits that you share with your son that you identified with that started to trigger the awareness that you may be autistic?
I suppose there are differences in how I would communicate.
Really?
So like differences in how I use language. So I use a lot of kind of planned speech as opposed to kind of spontaneous speech. So you can see here, I have like a bunch of notes written down, because sometimes I can lose words if I don't have a kind of a plan or a script, which is probably why I became an actor, because I always had a script and that was really handy. Or as a writer, I can write my own scripts. But also sensory differences. So you know, sensory challenges with loud noises, with busy environments, with lights, with textures, with heat, and the way that I understood the world, I suppose, and the way that I look at the world, as a kind of seeker of patterns, I suppose. Autistic people are really good at identifying patterns in, you know, in society, in numbers, in all kinds of things. And in how I interacted with the world, and in how, and autism is, it presents differently in different people at different times. So sometimes I would be very easily passing as a neurotypical person, and then other times, absolutely not. And I suppose those are kind of things that that would have been key markers in terms of, you know, looking for an assessment.
Yeah, and what a gift for your son as well. And congratulations on, you know, on that for him as well. That's just a wonderful story. So, okay, Grace. Grace is a companion piece to your other play, which is What I Brackets Don't Know About Autism.
Yeah, I've gone for a little short title this time instead of the big mouthful.
I love a long title.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I do actually. I like a little bit of an explainer, What I Don't Know About. Tell me about Grace.
So Grace is an hour of theatrical magic for audiences aged 8+. I think of it as a story for anyone who's ever had the experience of feeling like they don't belong. Unlike What I Don't Know About Autism, it's a story-based piece, and the story revolves around Grace, who's a non-speaking girl of about 13 or 14, and her parents. And the play is really Grace taking her through the kind of multi-sensory journey of her life so far. For me, I think it's about believing in someone. It's about believing in their capacity, even if the way that they experience the world is different to how you do it. And I suppose in reality, that looks like we've got three actors. Brian Burrows playing the ghost of Grace's dad, without giving too much away. And Grace Kiley, who plays her mum, and Eleanor Walsh, who plays Grace.
Oh, wow. OK, yeah. So what would you like audiences to take away or get from Grace?
So I'd like them to understand, I mean, fundamentally, it's a message of acceptance. It's a message that just because, so one of the lines in the play is, I didn't grow the way I was expected. I grew without speech, but not without song. And I think anybody who sees the play will appreciate that, even though the character of Grace doesn't use words verbally, she doesn't use her mouth in order to speak, she has so much to say. And that just because somebody appears to be non-speaking doesn't mean that they don't understand, doesn't mean that they don't have empathy, doesn't mean that they actually don't have loads of words inside them. Because a lot of the time being non-speaking is rather than an intellectual thing, it's a motor thing. So the words are in your head, but you can't process them into speech to get them to the other person, which is why people now use spelling to communicate or use AAC devices.
Wow, you're blowing my mind. I'm loving the sound of this. It's amazing. You say you're, these days you want to make audiences care about something on a deep emotional level through telling a rich story and complex characters and motivating them to make positive changes societally. Mm-hmm. That's a big ask. I love that.
It is.
That's
a big ambitious ask. Yeah. But you know, if you're going to do it and you're going to ask the Arts Council for money, you have to be doing something decent with it. But I think that's how I love to work. I love to work collaboratively, and I see the things in the world around me that I would like to change. And the only, I'm not a politician, I'm not a teacher, I'm not an educator, but the only way that I have to process that for myself and then to try and share it with audiences is through the work that I make.
You have done a lot of work as artist in residence in UCC. I mean, Fair City, Arts, Cork Opera House. But a big part of your work is promoting inclusion and diversity in the arts. Tell me
about
that.
Exactly. So that kind of came out of What I Don't Know About Autism. So that was the upside of COVID, was that we opened that show and I think 2 weeks later, everything closed. Oh. So I went on a trip to London to meet agents, to do this, to talk to theatres, and then everything, like the rug was just pulled out from under us. But what came kind off the back of that show was a lot of people were coming to me going, OK, you've made this work. Would you like to speak at this online event that we're running? But I became more interested in the sort of broader broader landscape of disability and access. And, you know, disabled people should have a right to access art. They do have a right to access art. And so a lot of the work and the research that I've done in recent years has been around access tools like relaxed performance, like having captions and sign language interpretation, having audio description, which we have. Now we're working on embedding that, and we're working with an amazing audio describer called Mo Hart on embedding audio description in every single performance of Grace. So a visually impaired person can come to any show and have access to that show. And then also touch tours, which are fantastic both for blind and visually impaired people, but also for neurodivergent people, because sometimes you just need to establish yourself in an environment to be able to sit and engage in an experience.
I'm reading here, last year you created Neurodiversity Theatre Festival in Cork.
Yeah.
Amazing. And early this year you created the first ever relaxed parade space for St. Patrick's Festival. Was that tricky? Like, that's a pretty noisy event.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is as well is that we kind of go, okay, a parade, it's not going to be for an autistic person. But like loads of autistic people are sensory seekers. So they're seeking noise. But it's kind of about how much of the rest of the environment you can control. So we know that the parade is going to be a big, huge, loud event. But if you're not in a crowded space, if you have access to quiet spaces, if you've access to sensory toys, or, you know, a place where you can run and, you know, it's not going to get crowded in that way, then you have control over loads of the circumstances. So then actually the big parade is becomes something to celebrate rather than something to be frightened of, because you're already you're in such a place of overwhelm by the time the parade starts, just from coming into town and standing in a crowd for so long that that you can't enjoy it. So we were trying to sort of control the circumstances that were within our control and create like a really spacious, really welcoming environment where families could come. And even if they didn't stay for the parade, like even if they just came in and, you know, used the tent with As I Am, or spoke to some people from Neurodiversity Ireland, or, you know, hung out in the big tent that had all the kind of bouncy balls in it, like that in itself, for some families, is the first time they've ever been able to access a national event like that.
You have such a calming aura. This, you are very calm. And maybe it's because after the interview with Dublin Airport. But you've got such a lovely way of explaining things. I want to just quickly go back to your newest work, Grace. And we actually have a clip we're going to play.
Oh, fab.
Have a listen.
The reason you're here today is that we've been told that you might be the sort of people who can believe. Can we hear without hearing? Can we understand without an explanation? Is there anyone in your life where the words don't matter? Where you don't have to say anything? Where you can just be?
Wow. What's that piece?
So it's so Brian, as the ghost of Dad, talks to the audience a lot. And for him and Grace, they've always been able to communicate without the words. It hasn't mattered. And for Grace and her mum, it hasn't been like that. So I think a lot of the time it can happen that when you have a child who's different, you're naturally fearful for them. So your first instinct is like, okay, I just have to make them fit in. And so the story is kind of revolves around Grace's dad dying, and then her having to find a way to bridge this kind of schism that's happened between her and her mum. And so the ghost of her dad supports her in finding a way to communicate. But I suppose that's Brian. He's talking to the audience about that sense of, like, even if we don't know what it's like to be non-speaking, we've all, you know, had the experience of feeling alien in an environment. And we've all had the experience of feeling like this person is home for me. And I think that's so he's kind of trying, I guess, to reach into the audience for them to kind of have their own experience of what person is that person for you.
You love this text. Great to hear this interview with Jodie. My daughter did not speak from 3 to 11 years of age and now speaks freely. Our journey has been about continual love and acceptance and educating those around us. We need to support our children more and never let them down. We're so proud of our daughter.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Because it is, acceptance is the key thing, isn't it? It's just going, okay, well, yeah, it's not for me to change you. You're right the way you are. And now we have to look at changing the world a little bit for you to be able to fit into it.
The global message of acceptance right there, isn't it? There's a lovely link between the theatre company who produced Grace and your mum, Geraldine.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I go way back with Graffiti.
You do,
so
don't
I'm
you?
So thrilled that they're producing this show with me, and they commissioned the work. So yeah, my mum was, I think in the early 90s, hired as a Graffiti Theatre Company's outreach director. And she worked there alongside Emily Fitzgibbon, the founder, for like about 30 years. She's now a wedding celebrant, so she's retired from theatre now. But she set up their youth theatre, and I entered theatre through that youth theatre. So yeah, I go way back, and then they commissioned my first play. They gave me my first acting job. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Jodie, you're a joy. And Grace, your new play for young people and families, for all people, is on in the Pavilion Theatre as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival from 27th to the 29th of September.
Yes, and also actually at Bavarois from the 12th to the 15th of October.
In Glasgow.
In Bavarois is in Galway.
In Galway.
Yeah,
in Galway.
It's the children's.
So tickets are as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival, people can find it. And they're all, tell me what the performance is. Describe the performance. It's accessible for everybody. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's a relaxed performance. Yeah. So what we're doing is we're kind of taking away some of those sort of invisible rules about theatre that act as a barrier for people. We'll be providing a visual guide so that people can, you know, get familiar with the space and how it's going to work in advance. We there is no not relaxed performance of Grace. So as, you know, Brian welcomes people into the theatre, he explains, you know, what the rules are, which is that you can come and go as you please. If you need to move around, if you need to stim a little bit, if you need to make a little bit of like vocalisation, that's all OK. And then we pause several times during the show just to check in on the audience as well.
Break a leg. Grace is on as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival 27th to 29th of September. Thank you so much for coming in.